walked into the room, frowning down at a sheaf of papers in her hand. Her sunny yellow dress seemed like the only color in the world. Hart frantically scrubbed his face with his hands before she looked up.
"I'm sorry, I didn't realize someone had come in. Did you ring the bell?"
He shook his head. He wondered if she could tell he'd been crying, and it made him feel defenseless. She was so pretty. Salt fucking sea. Did these places hire attractive women to match the chipper decor now? Was she about to offer him a plate of muffins? Her smile broadened, dimpling her cheeks. And those dimples, in combination with the fact that she may or may not have caught him bawling all over her dog, robbed him of speech. With each passing second that he stood there gawking at this ridiculously lovely woman in the lobby, his embarrassment and the irritation that went with it deepened.
"Sir?"
"I'm a marshal," he finally choked out.
"I see that. I'm Mercy Birdsall, office manager of Birdsall & Son."
She held out a hand for him to shake across the counter. He stepped forward to take it. "Hart Ralston." Sweat beaded on his forehead, and his hand pumped distressing amount of dampness between their joined palms. He tugged his hand back and resisted the urge to wipe it on his pants.
"I usually go to Cunningham's."
Her smile faltered.
"Oh, well, I hope you'll find our services superior. We take good care of our marshals here. Can I get you something to drink? Coffee? Tea?"
Falling all over themselves with cookies and smiles and customer service, he thought. Aloud, he said, "No, I've got a prepaid body for you." Mercy's smile remained, but the dimples disappeared.
"Of course, the dock is around back."
"Right." He drove the duck down the alley and backed it up to the dock, berating himself for crying over a dog and acting like an adolescent in the presence of an attractive woman. But he was discombobulated all over again when Mercy was the one who pulled up the dock gate rather than the undertaker or the son that the sign out front purported he had. Now that she was out from behind the counter, Hart could see the way the yellow dress hugged her ample chest and cinched in at the waist and flared out around her generous hips. He was beginning to resent this woman for making him feel perverted.
"I thought you said you were the office manager."
"I am. My father is the undertaker, but he's at the pyres this morning."
"The sign out front says there's a son."
"The son is 16 years old and probably in biology class right about now, so you get me."
She may have been the office manager, but she didn't flinch at the stench of death that wafted from the hold the second Hart opened it. She continued to soldier on with that smile, which in and of itself was infuriating. Why should she, or anyone else for that matter, be so sunny, especially at an undertaker's? She had no right to be full of life when she was surrounded by death.
"May as well squirt perfume all over a decaying body and pretend it smells like flowers," Bill said in his mind.
"What happened to this poor man?" Mercy asked as she handled the odd, lumpy remains.
The drudge had been so vicious that Hart had had to dismember it before lancing its appendix. But Mercy's comment sounded like an accusation, and from a woman who had probably never left the safety and comfort of her father's business, which profited off the dead.
"I did what I had to do."
"Mm-hmm,"
she answered doubtfully, and Hart cursed the federal government for the new ID tag law that forced him to interact with this judgmental office manager. The body stowed, he followed her and her yellow dress into the lobby, where the dog still lazed across the green velvet chair.
"Leonard, off," Mercy commanded.
But the dog gave her a confused expression that said, "I'm sorry, I have no earthly idea what you mean." The boxer mix looked nothing like Hart's own dog, but Leonard's demeanor was all Gracie, and a sharp pang of grief pierced his lungs. He scribbled his way through the paperwork in an attempt to get out of Birdsall & Son all the sooner.
"Is something wrong?"
Mercy asked him in a tone so snotty, he nearly offered her his handkerchief.
"No,"
he barked, signing the last document and slapping the pen down on the countertop. A strained grimace replaced her bright smile, and when she spoke, it was through gritted teeth.
Well, feel free to never come back again.
It was as if Hart were an overheated autoduck engine, and Mercy had opened the hood. A hot plume of words heaved out of his mouth. Lady, I can't tell you how much I don't want to come back here, but the government has other plans. So if you don't want to see me again, feel free to stop fleecing the suckers who come to Tanria to seek their fortunes, only to get turned into reanimated corpses. She propped her fists on those admittedly glorious hips.
Feel free to maybe not chop up those corpses into bits and pieces before my father has to send them home to their grieving families.
Your father is free to join the Tanrian Marshals anytime he likes if he thinks he can do a better job, and so are you.
She opened her mouth, but seemed to think better of whatever it was she had planned to say.
You know what? I'm not going to waste one more second of my life on you. Don't let the door hit you on the way out, Marshal.
He was a waste of her life, not her time, her life. Seconds ago, he had merely disliked her. Now he loathed her from the depths of his soul. He glowered at her before snatching his hat off the coat rack and heading for the exit. Behind him, he heard her mutter, "Arrogant demigod." Hart spun on his heel, trying and failing to come up with an answering sting as she stomped down the hallway to the office, and he was furious with himself for watching her ass until it disappeared out of sight behind the slammed door. 4 years later, as he drove toward an uncertain reception at Alma and Diane's house, Hart tried to imagine how that first meeting could have panned out differently. He came up empty. He stood on the front porch, bending and unbending the brim of his hat in his hands. He could hear a record playing inside, something jazzy and soulful, a melody that hit him with a wave of nostalgia for days gone by when he practically lived in this house. It had been so long since his last visit that it seemed almost offensive to show up unannounced like this. But he was here now, and didn't see the point in going back to his hotel room. So he combed his shaggy hair with his fingers and rapped on the door. The door swung inward, and there was Diane, her petite figure drowning in a loose-fitting sundress, her ash-blonde hair as short as ever, her cheeks and nose more freckled than Hart remembered. A smile overtook her face, and the crow's feet at the corners of her eyes lashed him with guilt for staying away so long. She let out a happy squeak and hugged him around the middle, her head barely reaching his breastbone. Hart hugged her in return and forced out an awkward laugh. "It's good to see you too, Diane." She held him at arm's length to examine him, her blue eyes shining.
"You need a haircut."
He laughed again, less awkwardly. "Who is it?" Alma's voice called from inside, inspiring in Hart the urge to hightail it to his duck and drive off before she got to the door.
"It's Hart."
"Really?" Alma appeared in the doorframe and squinted up at him, clearly wondering why he had decided to show up. It occurred to Diane to wonder the same thing, her inner mother hen bursting to life.
"Is something wrong?"
"Does something have to be wrong for me to pay a visit?"
"Is that a trick question?" asked Alma.
And Hart felt like he should either raise his hackles or be prepared to lick his wounds.
"You invited me."
"So I did. Come in." Diane hugged him again and took his hat as he stepped into the parlor with its overstuffed chairs and colorful afghans and pillows and stacks of books. A cat he didn't recognize grazed his shin as he followed Alma past the dining room and into the kitchen, where she pulled a bottle of beer and a can of soda from the icebox.
"Thanks," he said when she handed him the soda,
surprised that she and Diane still kept his favorite brand in the house when he knew neither of them cared for it. They made their way through the screen door to the deck that overlooked Alma and Diane's acreage with a neat vegetable garden and the chicken coop and the cows grazing on the taprooted grasses that managed to grow in the sandy soil. Hart dusted off the chair that was tacitly his and sat down. His long legs popped up like a pair of mountains in front of him, and he wished Diane hadn't taken his hat so that he could set it on one knee and fiddle with it. He felt like a child bereft of his security blanket. Alma reached over and clanked her bottleneck to the rim of his soda can. I'm glad you came.
So am I, he said,
although he wasn't certain as to the veracity of that statement. An unexpected wistfulness overtook him as he surveyed the familiar surroundings. This place was more home to him than anywhere else he had lived or slept since his mother died. But coming here had lost its homey luster over the past few years. He missed the comfort this place had once provided. He missed the comfort Alma had once provided.
How's your dad? He asked her,
a genuine question that sounded like empty small talk.
Good. I wish he'd let someone else take over the vineyard, though. He's too old to care for it like he should, but you know how he is.
Hard nodded, feeling guilty about the fact that he couldn't remember the last time he'd inquired after her aging father.
Seen your mom lately? He asked.
A few months ago. She says hello.
Hart nodded again. Unlike him, Alma knew who her immortal parent was. Bendina, whose tiny creek snaked to the north of her father's grapes in central Vinland. She even called her mom. It blew Hart's mind.
How's Deckers doing?
Hart rubbed his chin and took a gulp of soda, letting the two sweet bubbles fizz and pop almost painfully between his teeth.
He irritates the shit out of me.
Oh, you like him.
Yes, I do, Hart agreed in defeat.
So that means I was?
Right. You were right.
Mm-hmm.
Alma pursed her lips in smug superiority, which had the ironic effect of putting Hart more at ease rather than less, because it was an expression that belonged to Alma, his old partner, not Alma, his boss. He sipped his soda and set the can on the wrought iron table beside him.
Thank you for making me take him on.
You're welcome. I know you'll look out for him, and he's going to need it, with the drudge situation as bad as it is these days.
It does seem worse than usual lately.
It is worse. I've seen the numbers. There's a huge uptick in the keyless.
Diane backed out the kitchen door with a tray of carrots and celery sticks and crackers and cheese, and it occurred to Hart that he was ravenously hungry, something he generally failed to notice until it was hard upon him.
You'll stay for dinner, won't you? She asked.
Hart had come here with a family dinner on his mind, but he worried that accepting the invitation would mean committing himself to a lengthier stay than he wanted. Alma skewered him with her fierce blue-green eyes, and he knew she saw right through him.
I don't want to put you out, he told Diane. But of course, Diane was unputoutable.
There's plenty.
She planted a kiss on top of his head, making him go watery on the inside. Alma cooked chicken on the grill, while Diane put together a bowl of mixed greens and pulled some leftover potato salad from the icebox. They ate outside on the east-facing deck, with Diane catching Hart up on all the improvements they had made to the property recently. Hart answered the many questions she threw his way, but mostly he watched and listened, letting Alma and Diane's easy way together wash over him. After dinner, he and Alma stayed out on the deck, a silence thickening between them, while Diane cleaned up in the kitchen, humming along to the songs spinning off the gramophone. The old quarrel lingered in the air, as dense and swirling as the mist that shrouded Tanria.
You were a kid when we partnered up, and I always thought you'd grow out of it, come to terms with it, whatever. But you're in your 30s now, and if anything, it's worse.
Can we not talk about this?
We've been friends for over 10 years. When are we going to talk about it?
Never.
This is what I'm talking about. Bill's death is as fresh for you as if it happened yesterday. That's not normal. You need to deal with that baggage.
Bill was not baggage.
You act like he was the father you never had.
He was.
And I know he did you a lot of good, but you never stopped to consider the fact that he was also a sanctimonious pain in the ass.
Are you serious? All this time, all the years you've known me, this is what you thought of him?
Yes. This is what I think of a hypocrite who liked to tell people, especially you, how to think and act and live when he was the one who abandoned his wife and child in Honnick.
It was as if she had taken a sledgehammer to everything he thought he knew about Bill Clark. And in the process, she had smashed their friendship, too. Years of trust pulverized in an instant. He supposed he could apologize for his part in it now, but once again, he couldn't muster the nerve to broach the subject with her. In the uncomfortable silence, he let his mind drift to his letter-writing friend, to the unfair hopes he had already begun to pin on her for no good reason. But she seemed to get him, and he seemed to get her, and she made him want to live a little. Which was why he'd come here, wasn't it? "Thanks for dinner," he told Alma, pulling them both out of their brooding reticence. "You bet. It's good for you to be social every now and again. You're working too much overtime these days." "Don't have anything better to do, do I?" She shook her head. "You are a lonely bastard." The combination of Alma's endearing bluntness and Hart's soda-spawned sugar high made him laugh. "It's a choice, you know. It doesn't have to be that way." "I know," he said. "But it didn't feel like a choice. It felt like the hand he'd been dealt." "Maybe you should get another dog."
"Don't want another dog."
"Maybe you should make some friends who aren't me. Date somebody, take up Parcheesi." Hart could feel her eyes on him, but he kept his gaze turned toward the darkening horizon. "How old are you now? 35? Almost 36, right?"
"Yep."
"So when are you going to stop being 19? This time, he did meet her unwavering stare. 19 was how old he had been when Bill died, and she knew it. The unsavory truth hung like a ghost over him, but Alma didn't push it. "At least get another dog," she said. "A puppy. Puppies are cute. You haven't been the same since you lost Gracie." Hart pictured his dog exactly as she had been the day she came wandering into the campsite, sniffing out the spitted rabbit roasting over the fire, a half-starved mutt, gangly in adolescence, her ribs showing through a ruddy coat threaded with black. Alma had tried to shoo her off, but Hart called to her and held out a fist for her to sniff. She ambled to him on long, knobby legs and licked his knuckles, then pressed the side of her face against Hart's chest and gazed up at him with unfettered adoration. The adoration was immediately mutual. Gracie had been the salve Hart had needed after Bill's death, the light that had brought him back from a place of grief and darkness. For 11 years, she went everywhere with him, his shadow whose worshipful eyes reflected back to him a better version of himself, until she grew thin with age, and Hart had to carry her more often than not. After she spent 3 days laboring to breathe, sleeping fitfully, her body gave out in one great heave, taking his heart with her. "A copper for your thoughts?" Alma said to his profile. Hart was tempted to tell her about the crushing loneliness and the friend he had found by chance, but it felt too fragile to share yet, as if the letters would break apart in his hands and disappear forever if he confessed their existence. Diane came out, and the three of them stayed on the deck, laughing over old memories, the kitchen window throwing a square of light onto Hart's feet. Around midnight, a bone-weary exhaustion caught up to him when he thought about returning to his empty hotel room, and unable to withstand the force of Diane's hospitality, he found himself curled up on the too small bed in the guest room with roughly 50 homemade afghans piled on top of him. As he dozed off, he sensed Alma and Diane hovering in the doorway like a pair of mothers watching over a sleeping child. "I worry about him," came Diane's hushed voice in the darkness. "So do I, love," said Alma, gently stroking her wife's back. "So do I."
Chapter 11. "Fess up. Did you get takeout to dazzle this guy?" Mercy asked, as she and Zeddy set their plates beside the sink at the same time.
"No."
"You cooked dinner tonight? All of it?
I mean, you followed the directions. It's easy."
He nodded toward the cookbook from the library, opened to a recipe for chicken piccata. The pages were splattered with lemon juice and olive oil, but the end product had been phenomenal.
"I'm so impressed with you."
"Thank you," Zeddy preened. Pop's nightly food-induced coma had overtaken him, and one of his wall-shaking snores rattled its way into the kitchen from his recliner in the parlor. No higher praise than that, Mercy said, jerking her head toward the door. Are you going to amaze us with some dessert?
No way. Penn and I are ditching you losers to get ice cream.
You should rescue him from Pop's snoring before he experiences hearing loss. But Penn saved Zeddy the trouble, entering the kitchen with an armful of dirty dishes.
Need help cleaning up? You didn't want to hang out with the old guy who fell asleep in a puddle of delicious lemony sauce?
Zeddy asked, relieving Penn of his burden.
He didn't seem to be enjoying the pleasure of my company, but the dog did. Leonard and I are best friends now.
Mercy turned to her brother and mouthed the words, I like him. Aloud, she said,
Zeddy, you finish clearing the table, and I'll wash up so you two can get out of here.
Zeddy mouthed, best sister ever, before heading through the kitchen door into the dining room. Penn ferreted through the drawers until he found a clean dish towel to dry the dishes. This guy was getting better by the second.
So, Mercy, he half said, half sang. So, Penn, she sang in reply.
Guess you and Marshall Ralston aren't best friends? Mercy put a sudsy hand to her chest.
Whatever gave you that idea?
How did that start?
It didn't start. It was, is, and will always be an infinite loop of faded and mutual dislike.
She sank her hands into the soapy water to scrub a plate, wondering at the strange juxtaposition of pleasant, thoughtful Penrose Duckers, having to learn his trade from dour, scowling Hart Ralston.
I feel for you. I can barely stand the man for 5 minutes, and you have to be in his presence for days on end. How do you do it?
Penn shrugged. I like him.
No, you don't, she said in disbelief, handing him a slickly clean platter.
Yes, I do. He's nice once you get to know him. You should give him a chance.
He's had many chances with me. He has blown them all.
Zeddy returned, holding 4 wine goblets and 2 sweating glasses of water in his long fingers.
Did you talk about me while I was gone? Did you have nice things to say?
Mercy took the breakables from his hands one by one.
No and no.
Well, fix that. He waggled his eyebrows at Penn and whisked himself into the dining room once again to retrieve more dishes. Penn tilted his head at Mercy as he finished rubbing the platter dry.
Have you given Marshall Ralston a chance, though? Because you didn't even let him say hello today.
That's because he's as mean as a back alley dog. Better to cut him off before he ever begins.
Except she hadn't managed to cut him off this afternoon, had she?
She had let him cut her down. She had let him see her weakness and her tears. It made her shudder to think on it.
You've got him all wrong. I'm telling you, he's a marshmallow on the inside.
Who, me?
Can't argue with that, said Zeddy.
As he entered with 2 bowls mostly empty of the potatoes and the haricot vert amandine they once held, plus a couple of smaller bowls containing crudité. Mercy flicked dishwater at her brother.
We're not talking about you, you narcissistic twit.
Penn took the dishes from Zeddy, and Mercy caught the way his fingers brushed her brother's hand. A twinge of envy jolted through her. Zeddy's usually confident grin turned bashful as he pulled away to finish clearing the table. Mercy frowned at the sink as she spoke the next words.
He called me a grubby opportunist. As if I'm gleefully rubbing my hands together, waiting for the next dead body to show up.
That doesn't seem very marshmallowy to me.
I'm so mad that I let him get to me today. I practically handed him his victory on a silver platter.
Penn took a handful of cleaned silverware from her.
Is it a game? 'Cause if it is, it seems to me like you're both losing. Badly.
Humph. I think he likes you, Penn told her as he went in search of the silverware drawer.
Mercy gaped at him for a full 5 seconds before sputtering. He hates me. And I hate him.
I think he likes you. A lot, Penn said, dropping knives and forks into place with a plink, plink, plink.
A lot, a lot.
Mercy scrubbed at a stubborn chunk of potato stuck to the bottom of a pan, as if by doing so, she could scour Hart's sneering face from her memory.
You must be a hopeless romantic.
Nothing wrong with romance. It's not always hopeless.
Agreed. But me and heartache? That's the definition of hopeless.
All I know is he couldn't take his eyes off you. He was probably staring at my boobs.
Gross, said Zeddy, as he came in with the last of the dishes.
You're right, Penn laughed, directing his comment to Mercy. You two are hopeless, but I'll hold out hope all the same.
You're going to be holding out hope for a long, long time.
Mercy bumped Penn away from the sink and toward her brother with her hip.
Don't you guys have ice cream on the agenda? Scoot. I'll clean up the rest.
Best sister ever, Zeddy sang in falsetto, as he nabbed Penn by the hand and pulled him toward the door of the kitchen.
You think on what I said, Penn told her.
She laughed and shook her head.
Good night, Penn.
Mercy heard them giggling like a pair of schoolboys as they tiptoed past Pop and left by the front door, and the bittersweet twinge of envy stung her again. Once she had the kitchen cleaned up, she kissed her sleeping father on the forehead and let herself out. On the way home, she and Leonard walked underneath a new banner that stretched across Main Street. Mayor Ginsburg courteously invites you to celebrate Founders Day, 25 years of eternity, petting zoo, Equimaris rides, barbecue dinner, dancing under the stars, fireworks display. Normally, she loved a good party, but the prospect of being dateless and therefore danceless at the Founders Day party dampened her spirits. When she got home, she poured herself a bubble bath and drank a glass of Merlot as she soaked her weary body in the tub, trying not to get the pages of her romance novel wet. It was her favorite way to unwind at the end of a tough day, yet she felt listless now, unable to relax or focus on anything. Giving up on the bath and the wine and the book, she got out, dried herself off, and put on her oldest, raggediest, most comfortable pajamas. Leonard crawled into bed beside her, but his usually comforting presence depressed her tonight. She loved her dog, but he was no substitute for another human being. Not that Nathan had ever spent the night at her place. They'd always had to go to his apartment. She stared at the night-darkened ceiling with its jagged crack running from the window halfway to the light fixture, her mind busily turning over everything that had happened that day. The bills piling up, running into Cunningham at the cemetery. Nathan McDevitt with his thinly veiled threats of shutting her down once he was sheriff, and Hart Ralston's vicious words cutting her to the quick. I think he likes you, Penn's voice echoed in her mind. He's got a funny way of showing it, she muttered at the ceiling, making Leonard whimper in his sleep. No, Mercy did not for a minute believe that Hart Ralston liked her, but she found herself thinking about the last letter from her anonymous friend, seeing in her mind the way the blocky letters marched across the page. There are a few things about me that would surprise most people if they ever bothered to scratch the surface. What if Penn had a point? What if there was more to Hart than she knew? What if he was the sort of man who, like her friend, was hard to get to know in person? What would surprise her if she made the effort to dig a bit deeper? For the first time in 4 years, she wondered if she didn't have Hart Ralston entirely figured out. But she still couldn't stand the guy. Mercy dragged herself out of bed the following morning, maneuvering around the boneless pile of dog that was Leonard. Today cannot possibly be worse than yesterday, she promised herself as she turned on the coffee pot. But when she returned to her bedroom to get dressed, she caught sight of her disheveled appearance in the dresser mirror. Don't tempt fate, Mercy, she warned her reflection. A half hour later, garbed in blue coveralls and a matching headscarf, Mercy came downstairs in time to see Zeddy letting himself in, carrying a plate covered with a napkin, and whistling cheerily as he pushed the door closed with his foot. Look at you showing up on time, Mercy marveled. Cherry scone? They're homemade. How are you so cheerful and well-rested when you got up early to make scones?
Who said I went to bed last night?
If dating Penn means you get to work on time and bring baked goods to boot, I vote for keeping him around a while.
Mercy nabbed a scone from the plate, took a bite, and savored the buttery sweetness as it dissolved in her mouth, pairing beautifully with the bitter taste of coffee on her tongue. Yes, today was already far superior to yesterday, although as Zeddy set the plate of scones on the counter, he visibly deflated. What's wrong? She asked.
Penn had to go back to Tanria this morning. That's why I got up so early, to make him breakfast. He's not sure when he'll be in eternity again.
Sorry. I like him.
So do I, Zeddy agreed, before taking an enormous bite out of a scone. What non-corpse-related things do you need me to do today?
Do I smell something fresh baked?
Pop hollered from the office before Mercy could answer her brother.
Yes, but you can't have any. Doctor's orders, she yelled. I like pen, by the way.
Thanks, Pop. Me too,
Zeddy shouted in reply.
Pen would want me to eat whatever you baked.
Mercy relented and brought a scone to Pop before putting Zeddy to work cleaning the lobby. It had been too long since she'd done more than run the feather duster over everything, so she had him wash the baseboards and ferret out spiderwebs in addition to all the sweeping and mopping and dusting and polishing that needed to get done. It seemed like a solid plan until, shortly before opening, she heard Horatio's clack at the door. A klaxon of panic blared inside her at the thought of Zeddy getting his mitts on a letter from her friend. She didn't attempt to remove the thick layer of sawdust coating her arms and glasses as she raced for the door in the feeble hope of beating her brother to the punch. It was not to be. Horatio was in the lobby, studying Zeddy through a pince-nez clipped to his waistcoat.
I don't believe I've had the pleasure of making your acquaintance.
Horatio, it's me, Zeddy Birdsall. Remember?
The owl noticed Mercy and hooted.
My dear, I didn't know you had a brother. Why didn't you tell me?
Zeddy pointed at the sign next to the door.
That says Birdsall and Son. Who did you think the son was?
Oh, I don't know. I thought it was rather catchy.
To Mercy's horror, Horatio handed the mail to Zeddy and helped himself to the tip jar. He gave Mercy a saucy wink and whispered,
I do hope you enjoy all your mail this morning, darling. When you write to your inamorato, be sure to tell him that I send my regards. Ta-ta!
What in the name of the unknown god was that all about?
Zeddy asked, as he watched the owl sashay out the front door.
Horatio being Horatio, I'll take the mail.
What's an inamorato?
No idea. She reached for the mail, but he stepped away, flipping through the stack. A brick of despair landed in her stomach as an evil grin spread across her brother's face. He plucked a letter out of the stack and flourished the envelope in front of her like a magician at a magic show. She read the words, to a friend, before Zeddy oozed,
And what, pray tell, is this?
Mercy lunged for the letter, but Zeddy darted away, forcing her to chase him around the lobby as he cackled with delight.
Who's your friend, Mercy?
None of your business.
She snatched her letter away from her brother.
Mercy has a boyfriend! Mercy has a boyfriend!
Zeddy sang, prancing around the lobby.
Shh! She begged him, glancing at the closed office door.
It's not like that.
Then what's it like?
We're, you know, pen pals.
Right, he said.
But his shit-eating grin made it clear that he didn't believe her for a second.
Can we keep this between us? This friendship is new, and I... Can we keep this between us?
So Pop doesn't know about this guy?
No, and you're not going to tell him.
Wait, does Lil know?
No.
I know something about you that Lillian doesn't know?
Zeddy threw both fists into the air.
Right on!
Don't tell her. Or Pop. Please?
Zeddy slung an arm around Mercy's shoulders.
Sis, as long as you keep giving me all the time I need to tell Pop about not studying to be an undertaker at school, mum's the word on this pen pal. Deal?
Mercy had no idea how much longer she could keep Zeddy's secret from Pop, but she desperately needed some wiggle room to figure out a way to fight off Cunningham's buyout. Plus, she really didn't want Zeddy blabbing to anyone about her friend. She let loose a deep sigh of resignation.
Ah, deal. Now get to work.
You're no fun.
Zeddy released her and wrung out a rag over a bucket of soapy water, but as Mercy made her way to the boatworks, she heard his teasing voice behind her.
Tell your lover boy hi from me.
She growled under her breath, but by the time she stepped into the boatworks, she couldn't wait to tear into the envelope in her hands.
Chapter 12. Dear friend, I choose to ignore your accusation that I am a monster, because it is clear to me that you have never known the perfection that is a cup of good black tea. Incidentally, coffee tastes like the sum total of humanity's bitterness brewed into a brackish swill to be slurped with a grimace. While your hot beverage consumption leaves much to be desired, your occupation cannot be more horrific than my own. At least it is viewed as such by the general public. Personally, I find the interest rates at the bank repugnant, but for some reason, that line of work is considered squeaky clean. I prefer my own career path. It is a kindness, as you said, something that allows me to do good in the world. As for my not being alone these days, yes, I have a new coworker. He is young and naive and irritating, but I was young and naive and irritating once, so I won't complain. He keeps nudging me out of my grumpy, crotchety, curmudgeonly ways, something I never dreamed possible a few weeks ago. It's annoying, but also kind of nice. I would never admit this to him, but I will admit it to you, since we are always honest with each other. I like him, and I like having him around. Wonders never cease. So, your heart belongs to Cake. To what else does your heart belong? A specific place? A particular memory? Certain people? I hope you don't mind my scratching the surface. It's so much easier to do by letter than face to face. And the more I get acquainted with you, the more I want to know. I wonder, would either of us bother to scratch the surface if we knew each other in person? Or would we pass each other on the street and never bother to look? Knowing myself, grumpy, crotchety, curmudgeonly, I suspect the latter, which is why I'm grateful for your letters. I hope you'll write soon. Sincerely, your friend.
Dear friend, why tea? Why? Now that the most pressing question is out of the way, I must tell you that your letter could not have arrived at a better moment. I needed a friend this morning, and there you were. Thank you so much for that. I already like this new companion of yours. There's nothing like youth to snap you out of a funk. Not that I'm old, but I no longer qualify as young either. How old are you, I wonder? No, don't tell me. I like the fact that we stay away from the banalities of age and appearance and occupation, and I worry that the day-to-day facts of our lives would get in the way of our friendship. Could you be fully open and honest with me if you discovered that I was a hag with stringy hair and objectionable political views? Or I with you, if I discovered you were 6 inches shorter than myself and overly fond of onions? So, don't tell me anything about yourself except the important things. That's all I want to know. Although a tiny part of me does want to know where you work, what you look like, how old you are. You see, I refuse to lie to you, because those things are a part of who you are, too. But seriously, don't tell me. As to your question, re, to what does my heart belong other than coffee and cake? I love my father and my sister and brother. I cherish the memories I have of my mother, who died when I was 17 years old. I also love my family's business, which is unfortunate, since it seems destined to fail.
Dear friend, my mother got up with the sun every morning and worked her fingers to the bone until sundown, but she always made time to sip her tea and read a chapter from a book before facing the day. She raised me to value the very best of hot beverages, hence tea. I shall not be moved. Don't be mad at me, but I laughed when I read your letter. I assure you, there is no earthly way you are 6 inches taller than I am. I'm glad to have been there for you, but I'm sorry you were having a bad day when you received my last letter. Does this have something to do with your family's business? Your family sounds great, by the way. My new coworker comes from a large family, and they all seem to adore each other. Even when he refers to his brother as a punk, he makes it sound endearing. I'm jealous, to be honest. I don't have a family. Like you, I lost my mother at a young age, and she was all I had. I'm sorry for your loss, by the way. I know how hard that must have been for you. So, you want to know the important things about me? I'm not sure how to answer that. I get up in the morning, I go to work, I go to bed, lather, rinse, repeat. I suppose that's why my new coworker recently informed me that I need to live a little. How does a person go about living beyond getting up, going to work, and sleeping? The more I think about it, the more I'm certain that my inability to live a little is the cause of my loneliness. So it's self-inflicted, whereas your problems seem to be a result of circumstances outside your control, which is a shame. You deserve better. In other news, you have found me out. I live on a steady diet of garlic and onions and moldy cheese. I fully intend to breathe all over this letter. Now, about this stringy hair of yours.
Dear Onion Breath, I'm not convinced that your loneliness is entirely self-inflicted. Although, as your friend, who is always honest with you, I can't completely absolve you. Maybe the question we should both be asking ourselves is, what do we have the power to change? For example, there's a circumstance in my life over which I have some control, but I have chosen to do nothing about it. I'm trying to figure out how to confess this without getting into the particulars we have sworn to avoid. Basically, each of my family members has entrusted me with a secret that affects the other two, and I'm keeping my mouth shut because their respective responses are likely to upend my life and my future. But by keeping those secrets, I'm robbing each of them of the information they need to make decisions about their own lives and futures, especially as concerns my father. Does that make me a terrible, selfish person? Actually, don't answer that. I know the answer. Boo. Moving on. I think my favorite thing about you so far is your sense of humor.
Your current situation sounds tough. As your friend, I should advise you to come clean with everyone, especially since it's clear to me that you love and value your family. However, as the king of avoidance, I don't have a leg to stand on when it comes to this sort of thing. So I'll offer my support, no matter how you decide to play this. I find it hilarious that you think I have a sense of humor. There aren't many people who would describe me as funny. At all. Whatsoever. Although, I do have one friend with whom I let it fly. She and her wife put me more at ease than most, I guess. Then again, we've grown a bit distant over the past few years due to a long-standing argument. See? King of avoidance right here.
Oh my gods. You are one of those terrifying grammar nuts, aren't you? With whom? Really? And who is this friend of yours? Maybe you're not as alone as you think you are. Tell me all about her and her wife. I'm about to head out the door to my family's house for dinner. My brother loves to cook, as it turns out, and he's pretty good at it. Amazing, in fact.
When I was young, I practically lived at my friend's house, and her wife mothered me, which, truth be told, I needed back then. But then she became my boss, which has made things awkward. We had a falling out a few years ago, so I don't go over there much anymore. I'm not sure why I can't talk to her about it. I should probably unpack that. Speaking of dinner, your letter has made me ravenous. Do you have any idea how rare a decent meal is for me? Please don't torment me with words like pork tenderloin medallions, not when I'm sitting here with a plate full of canned beans. Do you think your brother might be willing to send a care package? My co-worker's mother sends cookies on a regular basis, which is nice, but I give my eyeballs for a well-cooked meal. I'm writing to you tonight under a starry sky. When you live in the middle of nowhere, you can see the stars, all of them, without town lights getting in the way. Do you ever look up? I mean, really look? I find myself staring at the stars more and more lately, wondering what exactly it is I'm doing here. Here, meaning the universe. Uh-oh, I guess I'm getting philosophical.
I stepped outside this evening, but you're right. The lights in town make it hard to see the stars. So I hopped into the duck and drove outside of town for a better look. The night sky is incredible. Why have I never bothered to appreciate it before? It's been right there all along. But I've been so busy thinking of this thing that needs to get done and that thing that needs to get done that it never occurred to me to look up. I don't know the names of most of the old gods, much less which star is who. Or which star is whom?
See what you've done to me, you grammar monster. If people can't remember gods, think how easily forgotten any of us are. It made me think about how I want people to remember me when I'm gone, for however briefly I'm remembered. When I'm on my deathbed, will I honestly be thinking, good thing I finished that to-do list? I suspect that I'm more likely to think, I should have told Pop about that big secret sooner, and I should have figured out a way to save the family business. I drove straight to my father's house and touched salt water to my mother's key and to the keys of every ancestor on the family altar. You'd think I'd be depressed after all this thinking and wondering, but I felt oddly light. Still do. I suppose it puts things into perspective. Or it's more accurate to say that you put things in perspective for me. To gaze up at the night sky and feel a part of something bigger than myself. I'm guessing that you spend a lot more time outdoors than I do. My job keeps me inside most days, and when I get time to myself, all I want to do is curl up with a good novel, preferably one that ends with happily ever after. Not that I'm able to sit down long enough to enjoy a cup of coffee most days, much less a good book. Wait a minute. I can't believe it's taken me this long to ask you what kinds of books you like to read, when I've known all this time that you're an avid reader.
Which star is who? To be is a copular verb that takes a subject complement rather than a direct object. Good job, you. Yes, I love to read. But like you, I often find myself busy when I'd rather be stretched out with a good book, my ankles crossed, the spine resting on my chest. My tastes lean more toward nonfiction history and politics mostly. Not many happily ever afters there, I'm sorry to say. To be frank, I have a hard time suspending my disbelief for happy endings, whereas I think you must be a hopeless romantic. Or a hopeful romantic? That seems more accurate. You keep on putting hope into the world. Someone needs to, and it's definitely not going to be me. On another note, talk to your family, friend, especially your dad. I can feel the weight of putting it off in my hands as I read your letter. And I hereby acknowledge that I am a hypocrite, who should definitely take his own advice.
Chapter 13. Since bodies were off the table, literally, Mercy was determined to make Zeddy fall in love with Undertaking via the gorgeous sweet chestnut she had handpicked at the lumberyard. How could anyone resist that grain once it was finished? And yet, Zeddy did not share in Mercy's enthusiasm as he helped her cut and glue and nail and saw, while watching the parts come together made Mercy's heart sing. You have to be careful when you're nailing it. Chestnut splits easily, she told her brother, hovering over his shoulder as he readied his hammer over a nail head. Zeddy glanced at the clock and set both hammer and nail on the work table next to the boat.
Lil and Danny are due back today. I should head home to make dinner.
It's 3 o'clock. Are we dining at senior hour?
Good food takes time.
So does a good boat.
You know I don't give a shit about boats, and neither do dead people.
Zeddy's snappish response made Mercy's eyes sting with hurt. Well, the living give a shit, and our boats mean something to them. Why can't you see that? He waved his arm, a big sweeping gesture indicating not only the boatworks, but Birdsall and Son, and everything the family business stood for.
Why can't you see that this is never going to be for me? I know what you're trying to do here, and it's not going to work.
You've never given it a chance.
I was never given a choice, and neither were you. This place is wringing the life out of you. How many hours of work are you putting in every week? Lil calculates it at 70 to 80. 70 to 80 hours of your life, every week, doing this. Is it worth it?
Yes, Mercy insisted, and she meant it. She meant it with everything she was.
Well, it's not worth it to me. I've got an apprenticeship in Argentina starting next month. I'm studying under the chef at Prosperpina's. After my 2-year apprenticeship, I'm going to open my own restaurant.
He might as well have spoken another language for all Mercy could understand him.
What? You keep asking me what I plan to do with my life. There's your answer. I'm going to be a chef.
A chef?
Yes. Mercy's lungs stopped working properly. She imagined herself crawling into the nearly finished boat in front of her and slowly running out of air as her brother sealed her inside, hammering in the nails of her doom.
Is this a paid apprenticeship, at least?
Zeddy breathed out hard and folded his arms. No. I'm lucky she was willing to take me on at all.
So Birdsall and Son is going to finance the Son while he abandons ship? That seems fair.
Mercy grabbed a shop towel off a sawhorse and hurled it at her brother. Zeddy threw it on the ground and headed for the door.
We are not finished, Zeddy.
Yes, we are. I can't argue with a brick wall. Mercy stomped after him through the boatworks door in time to see Pop greeting Lillian and Danny as they got out of the delivery duck at the dock.
There's Pop, Zeddy. Go ahead. Tell him to his face,
Mercy shouted.
Tell him how he spent his hard-earned money to send you to school so that you could study ancient Madoran philosophy.
Zeddy's lips went bloodless as Pop asked,
What?
Danny froze on the edge of the dock.
I'm going to go check on the thing with the...
He murmured something about oil and axles as he fled the scene to return to the safety of the auto duck. Zeddy's eyes blazed at Mercy, but that didn't stop the hot words that sparked off her tongue.
Tell him how he's supposed to let you freeload off him for the next 2 years so that you can learn how to cook. Tell him Birdsall and Son is only Birdsall now.
Pop frowned, but in hurt rather than anger.
Is this true?
Zeddy's bottom lip quivered. He nodded.
I have to pee, but I don't want to miss any of this, said Lillian.
Now's not the time for joking, honey, Roy chastised her.
I'm not.
Pop turned his attention to Zeddy.
Why didn't you tell me?
I knew you'd be disappointed.
You've got that right.
Zeddy bowed his head and sniffed hard.
And you, Roy turned on Mercy. You knew about this, but you didn't say anything when I got that buyout offer from Cunningham.
You're mad at me?
Mercy protested, but Zeddy had heard the words of his salvation, and there was nothing Mercy could do but watch as the situation got away from her, like an unbridled Equimaris making a break for the sea.
Buyout offer? What buyout offer? Zeddy demanded.
Lil piped in with equal enthusiasm.
How much are we talking about here? Can we make a counteroffer? Oh, mother of sorrows. Can you all please pause so I can pee?
We don't need Cunningham's money, Mercy insisted.
I beg to differ, Zeddy snapped.
I can't believe you, Mercy. This offer is my freedom. And yours too, for that matter.
But my whole life is here.
Because Pop made it your life. And mine. Hey now, that's not fair, said Roy. Fair? Was it fair that you assumed I wanted to follow in your footsteps? Was it fair of you to decide my whole life for me? And look at what you've done to Mercy. She's 30 years old and stuck in the same life you foisted on her when she was 17. How is any of that fair?
Zeddy's words rang through the dock, and then he stood there, quivering, as tears of rage slipped down his cheeks.
Zeddy,
Mercy began, but he cut her off.
It's true.
He's right, said Lil. It isn't true, cried Mercy, stomping her foot, though she knew it was childish. And you have no right to speak for me. None of you do.
Zeddy's eyes narrowed to cold slits as a ghastly smile spread across his face.
Say, Mercy, get any more letters in the mail from your friend lately?
Mercy's stomach dropped. She shook her head at Zeddy, but it was too late.
What letters? Asked Lillian. What friend? What's going on? And please, dear gods, I really have to pee.
Oh, didn't she tell you? Mercy has a boyfriend. They've been writing letters to each other. Right, Mercy?
Mercy strangled her brother with her eyeballs.
He's not my boyfriend, and you had no right to tell them.
What boyfriend? Pop asked.
He's a pen pal. It's nothing. I've never even met him.
The second the words departed her mouth, She wished she could reel them back in. Her stomach dropped a few more inches.
"You're writing letters to a complete stranger?"
Pop asked in his very best concerned father voice.
"No! I mean, sort of, I guess, but..."
Lillian cringed.
"Oh, mercy, honey. I thought Nathan was bad, but now you're dating a guy you haven't met? We're not dating. He could be an axe murderer for all you know. Or some sniveling old god's acolyte. No, he isn't. How would you know? You've never met him."
And now Pop put on his guilt-inducing disappointed father face.
"You keep Zeddy's secret from me? You waste your time writing to the gods know who. This isn't like you. Where is your head, Muffin?"
Mercy took in her sister's condemnation, Zeddy's glaring resentment, and her father's worry-worn face. They all thought they knew what was best for her, but had any of them bothered to ask her what she wanted? What would make her happy? Had any of them so much as scratched the surface? Or did they all assume she would go on as she always had, putting everyone else first without contemplating the toll she paid for it? Mercy matched Zeddy's quivering posture of outrage.
"Where's my head? My head is right here on top of my neck, thinking that there's at least one person in this world who cares about who I am and what I want. And he's not under this roof at the moment."
With that, she fled for the stairs.
"Unbelievable," said Lillian, as if she had earned the right to her long-suffering tone. "I'm going to the bathroom." "Hey, Lil's pregnant," Mercy shouted from halfway up the stairwell. "There, done, no more secrets."
Her feet thundered the rest of the way up to her apartment, but the sound didn't cover her sister's indignant reply.
"Mother of sorrows, thanks a lot, Mercy."
Mercy made her way to temple on All God's Day morning, arriving at 10 o'clock on the nose, when the votaries opened the heavy oak doors. She hoped to get in and out before any of her family showed up, since she was in no mood to confront them. So far, so good. She walked down the center aisle to the skylight at the apex of the temple's roof. The great arched ceiling above her was painted like the night sky, the altar of the gods who had come before, their stars shining in the darkness. The skylight was a symbol of the unknown god, the void beyond the sky who came to know their self, and who gave that self-awareness to the world. A sense of peace fell over Mercy as she stood in the sunlight streaming downward. When she was small, her mom used to read a child's book of the gods, old and new, to her and Lillian, and later to Zeddy. Mercy could still hear the cadence of her mom's voice as she read through the pages. The words brought her closer to the memory of her mother, and her mother's memory, in turn, brought her closer to the gods. First, there was the void. The void became aware of their self, the first and most powerful of all gods, the unknown. They created others, children made from pieces of their self. The children wanted to be like the unknown god, so they created their own children, more gods, but weaker than their parents, and so on. Eons passed. The first gods slowly tired of existing, and they vanished, leaving nothing but pinpricks of light as a memory of who they had been. Their children created the sky as an altar to their parents' memories, and when they, too, tired and faded, they became stars in the sky as well. Only the unknown god remained eternal, rejoicing and mourning each generation of their family as their children and their children's children came and went. Over time, the children of the children of the children of the children of the unknown god were so diminished that they could not make more gods. Instead, they hung the sun in the starry altar of the sky and made the world to go around it. They created land and seas and all the living things that dwelled there. Finally, three of them made children of their own, crafted from the land and sea. These children looked and spoke and felt like gods, but their beginnings and endings came one atop the other. One mother gave her children the gift of sorrow so that they would know joy. One mother gave them the gift of fortune so that they would know hope. And one mother gave them the gift of wisdom so that they would know their end and, therefore, appreciate their life.
Admiring this creation, the siblings of the three mothers gave people more gifts. Streams for fishing, woods for hunting, fields for planting, hearths for food and warmth. All of this pleased the unknown god, but many of the older gods grew jealous of their offspring's creation. They wanted humanity's devotion too, but they bought mortal praise with cursed gifts: power, war, famine, greed, envy, fear. This is how the old gods became most valued in the eyes of humans, and the more people prayed to them, the more powerful the old gods became. People forgot about the Mother of Sorrows and the Bride of Fortune and Grandmother Wisdom, and they took for granted the streams and woods and fields and the hearth. They prayed to the old gods alone out of fear of war, fear of starvation, fear of loneliness and despair. The unknown god took pity on the people that their children's 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 children had created, and while mortals could not be divine, the unknown god gave them each a piece of their self, the soul, and asked three of the new gods to fashion a way for these pieces of their self to return to them. One god set souls free of their bodies when it was time to go home, and he returned their flesh and blood to the earth. One god made the salt sea as a path from the world of the living to the void.